EU.
For we, the people, understand that our country cannot succeed when a shrinking few do very well and a growing many barely make it.
What the reality is the program has been guaranteed since the inception, and they've said publicly that they're not talking about doing anything, taking away that guarantee to current customers in any way.
One sun rose on us today, kindled over our shores, peeking over the Smokies, greeting the faces of the Great Lakes.
A poem from the inauguration. That's one of the things we're going to talk about today on Weekday as the program continues in the 10 o'clock hour. I'm Steve Scherr. We're also going to take a look at what's happened with the Sonics, talk about estate planning, and we're going to start with the GET program, Guaranteed Education Tuition Program. Is GET in financial trouble? State Senator and Majority Leader Rodney Tom is concerned about the solvency of GET. He has looked at the program, and he said that GET, a self-funded program, could have left GET 79% funded. And Rodney Tom says that if everyone now enrolled, including babies and toddlers, wanted their money right now, the program would be short $631 million. Is that scenario likely? And what is GET's solvency issue? Betty Lochner is director of Washington's GET program. She joined us to talk about the program and how it operates.
The $631 million that's being talked about is the shortfall is the difference between the program's assets and the expected program costs as of June 30, 2012. That's the point in time that we do our annual actuarial valuation. We do it every year on June 30th. And that's a point in time where you take the assets versus the program costs, and then whatever that difference is you're either over or underfunded. What that number means is that $631 million is if everyone that had money in the account took it out on that day, on June 30th, 2012, then we would be $631 million short. So, and we know that's not going to happen because, one, we have a lot of babies and infants in the program that are not going to be going to school on that day, or taking, you know, the chances of everybody taking it out on that day. So that's what that number represents, is if everybody took their money out on that day, how short would you be of paying for paying the current value for all of those accounts?
Well, if that's not the problem, then where is GET's financial woes? You're going
to
say nowhere, right? Is that what
I'm trying to come up with a very articulate way to say this, so that I don't sound flip. But the bottom line is GET is a self-sustaining program. We get no money from general funds. It's all completely supported by participants' money and unit costs. So included in the unit cost is the cost of future tuition expenses based on what the assumptions are for long-term tuition, what the assumptions are for long-term investment returns, and what the assumptions are for how many people are going to buy units, how many units are going to be sold. So there is a model, a very complicated model, that as long as the unit price is set and adjusted appropriately, there won't be budget woes. And the actuary report, I don't know if you've seen it or if you heard the hearing on whenever that was, but Matt Smith's report, basically he says in his report there's a 1.1% chance of the program running out of money in the next 50 years. The risk is really low as long as you keep the program open. An example of how this works, how the model works, is back in the year that we were just talking about, in 2003, when tuition went unexpectedly to 16% in that year. There was an immediate, and at the same time, investments went down. So there was immediate crisis point in the program. We continued sailing. The GET committee, the policy group that governs the program, that makes the policy decisions about the program, they decided to keep the program open and keep selling. Many, many states were closing programs because they were worried about the future liability and what to do. They decided to keep the program open. So all those people that continued buying units, even though they may have been underpriced for a few months, that money went in when the stock market was low. Then the stock market came back, the investments came back, and then we recovered those losses within 18 months. So it's a long-term investment program. There will be highs and there will be lows. But the model, as the way it's designed, and I think the actuaries' numbers demonstrate that, works as long as you can predict tuition. Now, tuition can be high, but it has to be predictable.
All right, two things on that. First, the state is guaranteeing the GET programs if there is a shortfall.
Right. If there is a shortfall, they have to come in and make an appropriation for students.
Has that happened?
And that's the big conversation that's in the legislature right now, is they don't want that future risk or liability.
Has that happened yet?
No, it hasn't happened yet. And it's predicted. Here's another thing that came out of his report is, if the program were to be closed to new participants right now, and if we use the evaluation that we just talked about, the cost to the state to continue paying benefits for all those customers once the fund is depleted, so is an estimated $1.67 billion over 11 years beginning in 2025. So that means that if they close the program, we could continue paying, making good on those guaranteed tuition for students until about the year 2025. That's when the program would be depleted, because there was no additional money coming in. There was no source, a recovery source coming in. They've cut that off. So it would take about 11 years before everybody that could use their units use them, because of the babies in the program that are not going to use them for 18 years. It would be $1.67 billion to finish out paying off those students.
So, Betty Lochner, the GET program is predicated on it being respected and ongoing, so that new money replenishes the system.
Well, you continue buying at the stock market, and the stock market gains returns, yes. So that's how the model works. There's three pieces to the model: expected tuition growth, expected investment returns, and participants in the program buying units at the right price, so that the units are repriced every year as those assumptions are change.
So University of Washington President Michael Young has said that he doesn't expect to see double-digit inflation increases forthcoming in the next year or so. Right now, a GET dollar, a GET will cost more than tuition.
It always has. There's always been a premium, yes.
A premium, because the assumption is that people are buying them for kids that are going to school more than 4 or 5 years from now.
Correct. That is correct.
Does tuition have to go up in double digits over the next 10 to 12 years in order for the current price of GET and the assumptions you've made about GET to work out for investors?
No, actually, there is in that actuary report, the assumption is a couple more years of high tuition, and then it goes down to around 5 or 6. So the long-term average still stays up around 7%, 8%, 9%, something like that. I mean, I can look that up for you, exactly. But there's no assumption that the double digits are going to continue in the long-term assumptions. And what that would mean is that the unit cost would come down, hopefully, as tuition, if tuition came down. But long-term, the assumption is still, if you look at the numbers, and there's some great charts on our website that demonstrate the unit, what it costs to buy tuition, 4 years of tuition now with GET, what it would cost if you paid as you went when the time came, and what it would cost with loans. And it's about quadruple in 4 years. I think it goes up to like $200,000 with loans for 4 years of school for a newborn that buys today.
I think it was the new head of the Senate Ways and Means Committee said the private sector should do this, and there's lots of opportunity in the private sector for these sorts of programs. The state shouldn't be in the business of guaranteeing tuition for its citizens. There's no question there unless you want to respond.
I don't have any opinion on that. I mean, I'm one of the administrators of the program that is in existence. What they decide to do in the future and whether or not, I mean, that's a different issue. What the reality is the program has been guaranteed since the inception, and they've said publicly that they're not talking about doing anything taking away that guarantee to current customers in any way. And so the current customers that are in the program are guaranteed, no matter what happens, that they will be paid at the current tuition when their student goes to school. What happens to future participants, or whether or not there's a program for people to invest in the future, that's really what they're talking about. And whether it's good public policy for the state to be in the business of it or not, that's for the policymakers and the decision makers to debate and decide. You know, personally, middle income families, that's the group that's benefiting from these programs. You and I benefited from this program, and we know how expensive it would have been had we not had GET. People that have higher incomes can pay as you go. People that have lower incomes, there's other programs available to them. But this is a program that was originally designed back 16 years ago to help families save for college in a safe and affordable way for the good of the citizens of the state. That's the original mission of this program. Now, and so
other states have had to step in and fund the shortfall in some of their 529 plans or their guaranteed tuition plans. What makes you think, based on your data, that Washington State couldn't run into that problem at some point?
None of those programs kept their programs open when the going got tough. They all closed them down, similar to the example I gave in 2003. We could have stopped or suspended the program. We would not have had the opportunity to have bought when the market was low and have it come back and to continue. They stopped and they locked in that loss, and that's what would happen in our state too, is if you stop taking new participants, you lock in the loss, and you have taken away any revenue source you have for recovering that. So that's what happened with those states. There's only four states in the nation that have guaranteed returns, always have been. None of those states have closed. You know, the states that have closed are ones that had a promise or nothing in statute. It was like, well, you know, we're going to pay you out at a weighted average or whatever the market is, some other formula. But it was not tied to a guarantee, and it was certainly not tied to the highest. And it was a very thoughtful decision back 16 years ago. When you go back and read the minutes of those meetings, they wanted it paid to the highest because they wanted families to be able to go to whatever school in Washington State that they wanted to go to and to be able to save enough to do that.
That's Betty Lochner, director of Washington's Guaranteed Education Tuition Program, the GET program. And full disclosure, yes, I was one of those investors. I bought GET dollars for my children's education. State Senator Rodney Tom represents Bellevue in Olympia. He's also the leader of the Senate Majority Coalition Caucus. Rodney Tom, thanks for talking to us.
It's great to be on your show.
So, did you tell the Seattle Times on Friday that the Guaranteed Education Tuition Program was a Ponzi scheme?
Well, you know, when you look at it from the standpoint that it takes new dollars to support the program, that to me is kind of what the definition of a Ponzi scheme is. You know, what we're trying to do is kind of business 101. Would we get in this program today if we were starting from scratch? And most legislators I talk to say no. So, you know, if that's the case, most businesses say if you wouldn't start it today and you're in it, then you should get out of it. And so that's why, you know, we're saying, you know, we should look at how we can get out of this thing in a thoughtful manner that minimizes our exposure.
Isn't Social Security under the same sort of foundation as the GET program?
Right, but you have to remember the state's in a very different position as far as the bond markets and our lending capacity. You know, the one thing that nobody ever talks about is, you know, $631 million You know, what we're trying to do is say, you know, we can't keep digging this hole any deeper. We have a lot of, you look at our pension systems, you look at our college bound programs, we have all of these out year liabilities that we can't continue to bankrupt this next generation by mortgaging their future. And at some point, you know, we need to step up to the plate and say, you know, we can't go forward with these programs if they're not self-sustaining.
Well, it's supposed to be self-sustaining, and you had the state actuary look at what changes were necessary with GET and how it becomes, how it brings back money into the system, considering the increase in tuition. How is it not self-sustaining?
Well, if it's self-sustaining, why does it have a $631 million deficit?
Well, what do you think of the argument that says that that's not really valid because not every toddler is going to cash out today? It's akin to saying Social Security is in trouble if we all cashed out our Social Security dollars today, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, we're not saying that every kid's going to cash out, but what we're saying is we have not had a very good track record in predicting tuition. And if you look at our out-year liabilities or out-year assumptions on this, we're saying that once you get past the next couple of years, we're going to have 5.5% tuition increases. We haven't been below that number since 2001. So what we're saying is there's a lot of assumptions built into this thing that is going to continue to increase that deficit. And what we're saying is the hole is big enough now. It's time for us to address it.
Well, if it's a hole, Betty Lochner said it's going to take a billion plus if we were to shut off new investments. Isn't that a bigger hole?
Well, you know, what Betty's saying is let's just continue to add to the liability and never address that liability. And unlike Social Security at the state level, we don't have, I mean, we, the bond markets will tell us as a state, you can only have so many out-year liabilities before we start to shut you guys down. And I think we're fast approaching that limit. And so what we're saying is we don't want to continue to make the liability to that program any bigger, and it's time for us to address it.
The state actuary predicted the funded status of GET through 2033 by 2032, so 20 years from now it's at 100%. It's at 86%, 89%, but it's gone up and down in the past. Isn't it predicated on not just the full faith and credit of the state, but also people believing that this is a program that is valuable and therefore will invest in it?
You know, obviously it's a valuable program, it's kind of like in the internet days, do you make up your losses by volume? What we're trying to do is operate like a business and say these things need to be self-sustaining. Obviously, this program has not been, or it wouldn't have created the deficit. And then also we're saying, you know, there's a big assumption out there that new buyers are paying $19 for each unit credit that they're buying to the past obligations. And for how long are they going to be willing to take on that? And even those who manage a program will say, you know, that's a huge unknown. And there's just too many unknowns on this that we feel if we're going to concentrate on the core function of higher education, which is at the institutional level and basic, you know, student financial aid, we need to address this program. You know, if you look at student financial aid, we have 31,000 students in our student financial aid program that qualify that are not getting funded. And so what we're saying is let's concentrate, you know, at the institutional level, let's concentrate on our student need grant programs, and let's make sure that GET doesn't become so dominant that it takes all the dollars out of the system.
But GET doesn't take any dollars out of the government system, does it? It's self-funded.
Well, it, you know, at some point, you know, if the $19 doesn't come, you know, if people don't continue to pay forward with that $19, it is not self-funded. And you're making a prediction that tuition is going to stay below 5.5%, which, you know, if I'm looking at past behavior, that just hasn't been reality in the system.
So you think tuition's going to go up more than double digits, continue to go up more than double digits. Michael Young was on the show, and he said he didn't think that was going to happen. He thought the tuition for the next few years was going to be about 5 to 8%. It's going to continue to be double-digit increases?
No, I don't think we're going to see double-digit increases, but I also think that 5.5% is not a figure that we've experienced since 2001. So I don't know why all of a sudden we're going to see numbers below that.
Do you call into question Getz's viability? Do you create a self-fulfilling prophecy?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think what we're trying to do is, again, I think there's too many areas of higher education that we are trying to address. We need to have a greater concentration and focus on those key areas. And that would be, you know, the underlying support of our institutions through direct funding to our universities and colleges, and then making sure that we have a state need grant program where no child is denied the access to a college education. And that's where we want to put our focus instead of always making sure that we're having to worry about this debt liability that continues to grow and grow and grow. And to put a blind eye to a growing liability, you know, is one of the biggest problems that we have in this country. You know, it's a credit card mentality that people on the street understand only works for so long, and then the piper comes due.
The charge that the committee had was to figure out if Getz interfered with the ability to do differential tuition for different programs at different universities. Is that what's driving this, so you can let universities raise their tuition higher for more popular programs?
Well, what we're saying is, you know, we believe that tuition policy should be set, you know, on a rational basis. And right now, the Getz program totally dictates tuition policy. And, you know, we have been very clear that a promise made is a promise kept, and so that anybody who is in the Getz program will have that promise kept. But what we're saying is, you know, 15 or 20 years from now, I don't want legislators to be in my same seat saying we have no rational control of tuition because Getz totally dictates our tuition policy here in Washington State.
So what you want is to be able to let popular programs raise tuition to what they see the market will bear. Does that mean some of those programs, how high could they raise their tuitions?
Well, I think, you know, what we're trying to do is make sure that kids have access. You know, at the University of Washington, in any given year, we have in computer science, you know, 300 to 500 kids who are extremely qualified who aren't getting into that into those programs. And every time I have a high-tech executive down in my office here in Olympia, they're telling me they need, those are the exact workers that they need. So what we're trying to do is figure out mechanisms that we can expand access to those programs that have great income potential and our employers are desperately in need of.
How does higher tuition in those programs expand access?
Well, with the higher tuition, I mean, a lot of those programs are simply, you know, they're labs. Anytime you're in the science, they're more expensive programs to run. And so the universities don't have tuition dollars to continue to subsidize enrollments that are more expensive. And so what we're trying to do is, you know, cover the true cost of some of those programs so that we can have greater access for everyone.
How much more money will go into higher ed under a Rodney Tom budget?
Well, I will tell you this. We will make sure that we haven't we stop the slide that you've seen in higher ed because I think it's critical. You know, if you look at what we're trying to accomplish down here, making sure that we focus on jobs and education and a sustainable budget, higher education is a key component to make sure that our employers have the talent that they need to compete in a very tough global market.
So at least status quo next budget.
Correct.
When you heard Betty Lochner, she's talked about this being a program for the middle class, that lower income students have opportunities, higher income students have opportunities. How will you help middle-class students get the money they need to go to college?
I think the way you do that is by supporting the institutions and making sure that they have the state resources so that they don't need to continue to tax students with higher and higher tuitions. If you look at GET, it's pretty, it's not clear who exactly, are those purchasers. And in a lot of cases, it's the upper income individuals who had the flexibility to, buy those GET credits. And so we want to make sure that the middle class and those who qualify for the state need grant are taken care of.
I just want to make sure I don't hear a contradiction. You are predicting that some colleges should raise their tuition higher to pay for popular programs.
Correct. I mean, we got some great programs out there that are world class. The students come out of there, they're making a very good wage. And if we're going to continue to expand to meet the needs of our employers, we're going to need to expand enrollments in those programs. And the only way that we're going to be able to do that is to drive more tuition dollars to those programs.
All right. State Senate Majority Leader Rodney Tom, I appreciate you taking the time. I hope we can talk again.
Thank you.
Rodney Tom represents Bellevue and Olympia. He is the leader of the Senate Majority Coalition Caucus. He is advocating a termination of the Guaranteed Education Tuition Program. This is Weekday.
Ten 31. Some estate planning advice in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Third Place Books. Young adult author Darren Shan discusses and reads his new book, Zombie Underground, from Little Brown, Monday, January 28th at 7 p.m. at Third Place Books in the Lake Forest Park Town Center.
33 degrees in Seattle with clouds and lots of fog. Forecast says fog through the morning should start breaking up after noon at some point. We might get a few sun breaks later today, and we're looking at a high of 38.
KUOW and Broadway Center present Circus Oz, Australia's national circus featuring acrobats, aerial artists, comedy, and live music, February 1st and 2nd at the Pantages Theater in Tacoma. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:32. In a few minutes, we're going to talk over the cultural mood of the city with local author Lindy West, musician John Roderick, and filmmaker Jason Reed. What is Seattle talking about and why? That's just 10 minutes away.
Katie Sewell, if you were to die today, which I do not advocate, would you have a signed will?
No.
Life insurance?
No. Nope.
Would your family know where your money is, how to get access to it?
No, probably not.
Huh. Well, you're not well prepared.
I even have like some money hidden around the house that would probably just, go with the movers.
All right. So what? You talked to Chanel Reynolds because she was in the same boat?
She was in the same boat. Her husband died unexpectedly. And all of a sudden, when she should have been mourning, she started to panic, asking questions like, can I afford to be a single mother? Where the heck is the money? Things like that. And so to help all of us not have that experience, she created a website to guide people through estate planning. And I asked her, what's on the website?
The idea for this project first popped into my head when I was literally standing in the ICU at the hospital, having to make some very hard decisions about what my family was going to look like. And my husband was hurt so badly in an accident, he wasn't going to be able to come back. And while I was trying to stay present enough and listen to what the doctor was saying, I had this enormous mountainous swirl of thoughts and worries and details in my head that I didn't have answers to.
What kind of details? What were you thinking about?
Really big things like wills and living wills and life insurance policies. I didn't really know for sure where they were and what they were. And then one of the things that really surprised me was the number of small, little, easy details like passwords to phones, passwords to computers, teeny things that would take 4 seconds to write down that because I didn't have, it took me hours and hours and hours of tracking down and or never being able to find what I really needed.
And what had your husband and you actually accomplished?
Mm-hmm. We had about half the stuff done. And the things that really saved me were getting life insurance policies when our son was born. We had our wills drafted but not signed, which makes them non-legally binding, but I knew what his wishes were. We also had had conversations about our living wills, which made it easy for me to know what to do. But there was a bunch of other stuff that was like left undone or ignored or I never found.
What would you say is the thing that people overlook the most?
I'm glad I spent the time on now collecting items from my late husband's past that I can share with my kids as they get older. We spend a lot of time collecting, you know, stuff from our children's childhoods, but not enough from our adult lives. So giving the kids a box of things where that they can touch and hold and feel and get a sense for who their dad was and his personality and what his interests were, things he touched every day, I think is one of the things I'm most proud of and relieved to be able to give to them.
What sort of things did you put in the box?
Basic, like, items he'd touch every day. His wallet, his ring, his car keys, his phone. It also has music that he wrote and was in a band in his past, grocery lists. Honestly, it's not a big deal, but the fact that his funny scribbly handwriting is on it is really, really nice. His favorite sweater, some of the things that I really associate with who he was so they can know him.
And on the website, you mentioned that it might be a good idea for people to start doing that when they're alive, putting these boxes together.
It's so easy to tackle these items just one at a time. Just put a little area and then every now and then, you know, drop something in that kind of reminds you of you or you thought was funny.
I'm speaking with Chanel Reynolds, who created a website to help us plan our estates before we end up in a terrible situation. And it is a website that's name I can't actually say on the radio. And you can find a link on our website. Another thing that you said on the website that I thought was interesting was you suggest that in doing some of these things, you might find that you need to make new friends or make your friendships tighter than they currently are. Why is that?
One of the things that saved me, literally, from getting through a really hard time was the number of friends and family who showed up to help me. It made it seem a little bit easier to get through the day when I had so much help. The other thing that really kind of brought me to my knees was after spending about a week in the hospital, pretty much 24/7, I noticed that there were a lot of people there in the ICU who didn't have a lot of people with them. And the thought of going through something so scary and hard by yourself was really hard to take.
But people could find that in thinking through who would manage their estate, perhaps after they die, they might find that there isn't an obvious person. Is that one of the worries?
Well, your question is interesting to me because it really is about, like, when you're going through your will and if you don't know who to list, mm-hmm. like, that's a problem. I really think being part of a strong community of people where you are a good friend to them and you can count on them to be a good friend to you when you need them most was one of the things that took me through the hardest time. And tending to your friendships the same way you tend to your work and to your relationships is really, really key. So you do have a few people who you would trust to love and take care of your kids if you weren't able to do that.
On your website, you have a checklist that guides people through the different steps that they need to do. A will, life insurance, long-term disability, all these things. But one of the items that you have that to check off is this statement. I have deeply considered how my life lines up with my values and priorities, how I'm spending my energy, and what I want to do differently to have the life that is meaningful and important to me. Why did you include that line?
That is my favorite line, actually. When you're sitting down and writing your will and your living will, it brings up some really big questions. And I think while you're considering who you want to watch your kids and where you want your favorite things to go when you're gone, it makes a lot of sense to really think about the life that I'm living right now. I don't want to waste a single day.
So how did you shift your life after this?
So after the accident happened and I had had a few months for life to look somewhat normal again, every day that I would go to work or go to the store, I kept thinking about how, if this was my last day, is this really what I want to be doing? And so I spent more time with my family. I chose different projects that I worked on, and I really started prioritizing fun in my life.
Do you think that your husband did that while he was still here?
My late husband, Jose, and I had a really wonderful life together, and we worked hard at a successful marriage and a happy family. And I feel like one of the things that helps when I talk to my kids about him and we share memories together is that we don't have any regrets about the choices that we made.
So if people are intrigued now and they want to get their act together, where would you say is the most important place to start?
I think everyone should have a will. On the website, I have posted the will that I used, and that's exactly it. It's the Washington State will that I used, and it's a good reference point or starting place for people. There are a number of ways to get a will done. Absolutely, you can work with a lawyer. There are also online software or online programs you can go to that can be less expensive than going to a lawyer. And there are some people who choose to do it themselves. Depending on your situation, all of those could be really good options. But I highly encourage folks to know and understand everything that's on their will and make sure that if they have any questions that they consult a professional.
Chanel Reynolds has created a website to help you get your act together when it comes to your estate planning. You can find a link on our website, and I can't say the name of the website, but it is Get Your S Together. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thirty-four degrees in Seattle with clouds and fog. Forecast says heavy fog through the morning, should be breaking up around midday. We might get some sun breaks this afternoon. Maybe, maybe not. Hard to say. Overnight clouds, chance of rain, low of 37. Tomorrow, Wednesday, rain expected with a high of 44.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets. PCC embraces the winter season with organic Rio Star grapefruit, fresh winter greens, and hearty soups with 9 neighborhood locations. More at pccnaturalmarkets.com.
Dim sum warriors. Those little Chinese snack foods know kung fu.
Holy hot sauce!
And they're bilingual.
我的星星辣椒酱!
Their comic book adventures are an iPad app. Kids learn Mandarin as they scroll and tap through the story.
It's like you're doing two things at once, but you don't even know.
Learning Chinese with an app, next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hedvig and the Angry Inch, a co-production with Balogun Theater, starring Jarek Hoffer, live at the Moore Theater, now through January 27th. Tickets available at stgpresents.org.
It's 10:42. I'm Bernard Ouellette. 4 decades after Roe v. Wade, we're going to take a look at where the debate over abortion stands today. That's in 25 minutes on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still, just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone. To hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth.
That's President Obama. He's in our chat room virtually. We're taking that up as we take a look at some of the big stuff of the past few days with Jason Reed. He's the director of the documentary Sonic's Gate, currently working on a documentary called Evergreen, the Road to Legalization in Washington. It's about marijuana.
It is.
Yes, not about legalizing other things. John Roderick, singer, songwriter, guitarist, podcaster of Roderick on the Line with famous internet personality Merlin Mann.
That's right. Many layers of fame.
And Lindy West, local writer and humorist.
And luminary.
She writes for the blog Jezebel, co-author of How to Be a Person. Mm-hmm. Written in collaboration with members of the staff of The Stranger. Many people in that group.
Mm-hmm.
All good people.
Fine folks.
All people who know how to be persons.
I would say they're qualified, yes.
All right, fair enough. You made me sad about the inauguration. You revealed something I did not know.
I know. I dropped a bomb on you.
You did.
Well, I assumed everyone had heard. I assumed it had gone out.
I'm sure it has. I just was hunkered down
over the emergency alert system.
I'm still reeling from the news.
Yeah. Should we announce it?
Please.
The news is that our gal, Beyonce, lip-synced the national anthem at the inauguration.
I can't bear to hear it even the second time.
I know. I cried when I watched it the first time, and now I'm crying for
a whole
other reason. I mean,
did President Obama lip sync his inauguration?
No.
Inaugural address?
The whole thing was a hoax. you can see there, it's like the moon landing. There's two different light sources.
What direction is the wind coming from? It's not really that surprising, because the reason I started crying when I was watching it is because I couldn't believe how good at singing she was, because it's totally flawless. And you know, the acoustics have to be insane just outside in a giant whatever mall. But I'm not really that surprised, but I'm kind of bummed out.
Well, don't you want things to be real at events where you think everything is happening in real time?
Yeah. And also because I feel so cynical about politics. I mean, and I'm not a particularly cynical person, but you know, you kind of assume that everything is like kind of, you know, staged and approved in advance, and everything is orchestrated. So then it's nice. Like, it's already an effort to believe that, like, Obama means something, and then you feel something, and then it's like, no, this is a...
Well, I know they had an incident with Lupe Fiasco speaking out the night before, so maybe there was some concern there. Who knows?
Beyonce was going to make a statement.
The whole thing is a symbolic gesture to have a giant party on the mall, because they swore him in the day before, officially, in a small room somewhere.
True.
So to have a big symbolic gesture and then have part of it faked is the wrong kind of symbolism.
Do they lip sync do they lip sync the Star Spangled Banner at football games?
No.
I mean, does this happen in other places?
No, you can tell because it's often terrible.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah, I agree.
At least it's real.
I would like to have heard Beyonce really sing the thing. And if there had been little mistakes, I would have felt something in my heart about the beauty and the pain
exactly.
of America.
Exactly. I followed the inauguration on Twitter. I didn't watch it because watching things by following them on Twitter now is the new watch.
Who was tweeting the inauguration?
Everybody. I let other people filter real-time events for me through Twitter. But people, when Beyonce, apparently she pulled her earphone out at one point, and it was a dramatic, like, I don't need this.
Yeah.
I'm just freewheeling. And people were really excited about it. And now it's
probably, we know why.
It's probably
super moving. We wrote a whole article about the ripping out of the earpiece on Jezebel.
And really, she was ripping it out because it was playing, like, some Disney theme or something, or like podcasting or something.
Did you get anything else from the inaugural, any of you? Set America on a new course?
I thought it was, it's always nice to hear the president stick up for the gays and equality. That's such a huge change from just a couple years ago.
Well, like, for this president, 9 months ago?
Yeah. I mean, and he was like, this is unacceptable, you guys. You guys, come on. Can we pull it together? This is ridiculous. So that's always, I mean, that's actually kind of hugely important.
A big deal.
Yeah.
I felt like the whole speech was, he was being conciliatory, as he is wont to do, to the Tea Party or whatever, trying to explain to them why we work together instead of all living in huts that we make out of our own poo. But he really, it was a laundry list of, like, you know what? Now we're going to keep implementing the New Deal. We're going to keep implementing the Great Society. We're going to keep implementing all of these liberal programs that we have, that have been working for the last 60, 75 years, that you have been trying to tear down. And Nixon didn't defeat them, and Reagan didn't defeat them, and the Imperial Bush years didn't defeat them. We're just going to keep plugging away because liberalism is correct.
Well, Nixon actually expanded and brought in new programs that would now be
considered liberal.
Liberal, yeah, considered liberal. Did you tweet it? Did you watch it?
No, I was honestly so distracted by the Sonics tweets they were taking over my timeline that I barely noticed the inauguration was happening. I mean, that was another Twitter explosion yesterday.
Perhaps the president should have talked about NBA basketball a little bit.
You know, he is a basketball fan, and, you know, he probably remembers beating the Sonics back in 96 with the Chicago Bulls. So, yeah, he probably has fond memories of the Sonics.
He could have at least acknowledged it. I mean, it's the least he could.
It was pretty big news.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. I'll give you bigger news. So, Lindy West is local writer and humorist. John Roderick, he's a podcaster.
That's right.
Roderick
on
the line.
You don't even need to say guitar player anymore.
Nope. Jason Reed is director of Sonics Gate, which was subtitled Requiem for a Team. Kevin Johnson, mayor of Sacramento, just tweeted, because as you say, all things
That's
are
right.
on Twitter.
Up to the minute.
Big announcement to come at 2 p.m., City Hall.
Uh-oh.
I keep getting asked, do we still have a shot? You better believe it.
Whoa.
Yep.
So he's saying, big announcement, 2 p.m., he's going to maybe crank out some big cash.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, the city of Sacramento is doing everything they can to save the team right now. Unfortunately, it looks like Chris Hansen now has a binding agreement with the Maloof brothers, which basically means that they're going to own the team, and there's very little that can be done locally in Sacramento to save the team. But that said, the team is still there. They're still playing games in Sacramento, and he's supposedly assembling a big new ownership group that could come in and buy the team and keep them in Sacramento. They'd have to build a new arena. All this would have to happen before the March 1st relocation deadline. April is when Kevin Johnson will have a chance to speak to the owners, give one last kind of stay of execution, one last speech. He's going to have all his ducks lined up. And, you know, where Chris Hansen is and the city of Seattle is far ahead of where Sacramento is. We have an approved arena agreement. Yes, there's some things, some lawsuits and whatnot, but for the most part, it's looking like it's going to go through, which is a lot further along than Sacramento.
Well, what are the chances that they will buy the team, buy the Sacramento Kings, and move it to Oklahoma City and have Oklahoma City have two basketball teams?
I would say very low probability, although I would take the Oklahoma City team back and give them the Kings if that were possible, because then we'd get Kevin Durant and the team that was in the NBA Finals last year. But
right, now,
that's not going to happen.
Now, what if Kevin Johnson does this, all you believers in the people's power? This is what he said on Facebook. When it comes to keeping the team in our community, Sacramento is playing to win. In particular, we have been focused like a laser on identifying an ownership group that will both have the financial resources desired by the NBA and the vision to make the Kings the NBA equivalent of what the Green Bay Packers have been in the NFL. Now, I sort of took that to mean sort of local ownership or community ownership, but he's really talking about maybe something else. What if it was community ownership? Wouldn't you feel bad about taking it directly from a community now?
Well, I don't know when the last time you were in Sacramento was, but I would not feel bad about stealing from the Sacramento community. That river floods every few years, and the whole town is under 6 feet of mud.
How about you?
I mean, the thing is,
going to do to Sacramento what you said was done to us in your movie.
Well,
right?
I personally am not doing anything. I am just a fan. I am just a fan of the Sonics. We did make Sonicsgate in order to facilitate bringing a team back, provide a place for people to come together and heal and learn about what happened. But that said, the NBA has made these rules of the game. This is big business. This is the business of professional basketball and professional sports. And bottom line is, if an owner wants to sell a team to another owner, like what happened here when Howard Schultz sold the team to Clay Bennett, it's basically that owner's decision to do with the team what he wants. And Clay Bennett wanted to move the team to Oklahoma. The difference is Clay Bennett lied to the people of Seattle for over a year because he had an agreement with Howard Schultz that said he'd give a good faith best effort to keep the team here. He never wanted the team to stay here, and as soon as that year was up, he was doing everything in his power to move it to Oklahoma City. The difference is Chris Hansen's going in. He's not going to lie to the people in Sacramento. He's not going to give them false hope. If he buys the team, everybody knows he's moving him to Seattle, and that is different.
Booyah!
Just one thing. Did you actually believe him? Did you actually have that hope?
It's a complicated thing. I had the hope. I don't know that I believed him, and certainly it was a depressing day when Howard Schultz sold the team to Clay Bennett. I think we all knew the writing was on the wall, but I had hope up until the last minute, right before Greg Nichols settled and allowed our team to leave. I was hoping that the judge would rule in our favor and we'd keep the team here, but unfortunately, our mayor had a kind of spineless move, and luckily we have a mayor now who's supportive of our cause.
See, Kevin Johnson.
Word.
Big business. NBA big business. What do you think about this story? Are you a basketball follower at all?
I care about basketball the most of all the sports that I don't care about.
Really?
Because I did play basketball, so I do know the rules. And I I found it to be enjoyable. I went to basketball camp. This is not really relevant to the story. No, I think it, you know, I have sentimental feelings about the Sonics just because they were around in my youth. So I suppose it would be nice to have them back.
By the way, do they have to be called the Sonics?
They do. It's part of the agreement that Chris Hansen has with the city. And also that was part of the settlement agreement. The only thing that Mayor Nichols did right was to retain the name and the colors. So they will be the Seattle Supersonics.
I just feel bad. I have the opposite feeling of John about Sacramento. Hasn't Sacramento suffered enough by the people having... I mean, I'm sure there are some lovely parts of Sacramento.
Listen, Sacramento has not suffered enough. I hereby call down the plagues on Sacramento.
Wow. Toads?
Wow. No,
I think that a lot of us Sonic fans, we did live this and we did experience this as fans. And we do feel terribly and we know exactly the emotions they're going through. I mean, they are going to not give up hope just like we didn't give up hope until the team is actually relocated and in Seattle. And we respect them for fighting. We respect Mayor Johnson for fighting. I think it's fantastic. I just unfortunately feel like the powers are too strong and the momentum's too strong to get this deal done. And unfortunately, I think it might be too little too late. But more power to them for trying.
It is a big business that's happening here. And I think that this issue could be better resolved by my long-standing proposal that cities have stick fights to resolve the issues like this. The sports teams can be traded by billionaires, but really we should each field a stick fighting team and meet on a field of combat.
Or a game of riddles.
Ooh.
How about that?
I would go see either of those before I paid the money that we'll have to pay to go see a Sonics game. And that would be more community-oriented, too, a game of stick fight with riddles.
What?
Right? Wait a minute. High five.
I think you guys got something going there. All right, so the inaugural, Sonics, excited. Anything else happen in the world that you've been excited about before I go to record stores?
Well, that was the big news on the Seattle indie rock front.
Yes, yes.
Easy Street Records closing.
One of them closing.
Well, right. I'm sorry. Yeah, the Queen Anne location.
They're still there in West Seattle.
They sure are.
And I don't want to say anything. Record
God
stores?
Bless them. What do you mean? Why are you shrugging it?
I mean...
Record stores shrug.
Yeah, where do you get your music from? Record stores? Is that what you do?
Record stores?
You go for the Twitter with information, but records, why don't you get 78s and wire recordings?
Record stores are important to the community, like hardware stores or like all small businesses that cater to niche markets.
So you just want a place where we can go and share music.
Well, not just music, but all the culture that attends music. I mean, Easy Street doesn't just sell records. They have in stores. They have DVDs and comic books and the whole alternative culture.
They have comic books there?
They do.
Oh, well, then I am sorry they closed.
They are one stop shopping that is kind of curated.
But can't we just – all right, so records, the problem is they're not selling enough records, right?
Well, the problem is that everybody goes online and downloads whatever to their wherever, and nobody goes out anymore. Americans are just in their sweatpants all the time. They're dandruff-covered sweatpants.
Yes, it's amazing.
It's terrible.
What's your problem?
We need to get out into the streets.
Come on, don't you go? This is obviously why we need a basketball team, because otherwise we won't go anywhere at all. Don't you go out still? Just don't buy records?
No, I don't. I don't leave the house.
She logs on her computer in the morning to work, and then stays on her computer throughout the night consuming media.
Okay, that's really depressing, because that's not that far from the truth, and I know you were making
jokes. I mean, it's just it's a change in how things are going. Right now we're dealing with this in the film industry, too. There's no blockbusters to rent your movies. You know, people aren't really buying DVDs so much anymore. In fact, they might even end making DVDs in the next couple of years. I mean, it's all going to digital. Netflix, iTunes downloads, Amazon downloads, and the same thing's happening with the movie industry. Music industry. You used to go to Easy Street. I used to go to Easy Street and Silver Platters and look for DVDs as well as music. And that just the hard copy stuff is going away. That media is ultimately changing.
All right. But don't you think in 30 seconds that just means a different business model? Because we still do want to get out. We still do want to share experiences. We need a kind of a jukebox in those stores where we can share the virtual songs.
Yeah, there's no standing athwart progress and saying stop, but it is an opportunity to mourn because it's the end. It is the end of an era. I played in stores at that Easy Street a dozen times.
I'm just saying, maybe you could step up with some of that big cash, rent that space, and still do in stores.
Well, some of my big indie rock cash. maybe I'll hook up with some of that big stranger Jezebel cash. Yeah.
Feminist blogging and bucks.
Some of that documentary.
Right, big money maker.
I think if you guys pool your resources, amazing things could happen. John Roderick is a songwriter, a singer. The Long Winters is his band, and his podcast is on the line with Roderick.
Right, Roderick on the line.
I like Roderick on the line. On the line with Roderick on the line. It does sound better. I agree with you there. But I kind of like on the line with Roderick because it leaves you hanging. Jason Reed is director of the documentary Sonic's Gate, working on a documentary called Evergreen, and looking forward to the Sonic's return.
You actually make an appearance in Evergreen, too. Debate.
Oh, the debate?
Debate between Doug Hyatt and Allison Holmes.
Not out back where I'm...
No, we actually didn't use that
marking
clip.
A J here before the show.
That's every day. And Lindy West is local writer and humorous author of How to Be a Person with all those people at The Stranger.
All of them.
And also blogs at Jezebel. Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you folks tomorrow. This is Weekday.
Take your high tops and your whack shots to the hot shop. Cause in the supersonic hop, we don't play slop. And if you come into the crib, you're bound to get jacked. So take that J back, fool, cause we ain't having that. And this house suits rarely are defeated. And other teams come and get severely mistreated.
It's 11 a.m.